This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. And think of this hour as a journey from ancient Athens to the Continental Congress to ancient Rome to a death row prison cell in Maryland to a bloody street in Birmingham, Alabama in 1963 to a cell block at Guantanamo Bay Detention Center and beyond. At every step in this special program, along the way, we will be seeking justice. What it is, who gets it, who doesn't in our society and around the world.
8 years, 10 months, and 19 days, and 2 years on death row for something I didn't commit. I say do away with the death penalty forever. What we have to realize is that we are fallible.
That's Kirk Bloodsworth, a former death row inmate who has lived the story of justice denied. Then a vindication. He was exonerated by DNA evidence 20 years ago, his life saved. Kirk also tells the story of what justice, in the end, could never restore to his life. We'll hear more from Kirk Bloodsworth later this hour, and a case which helped to move Maryland to this week become the 18th state to abolish the death penalty. We want you to think about cases of injustice, to think about what justice means in our time, and what pillars from philosophy and religion support our ideas of justice. We want you to be like one of the ancients. Complete this sentence. Justice to me is...
This is Judy, and I'm calling from Everett, Washington. Justice is very much a personal experience, and in my life I have noticed that it is often confused with vengeance. I think maturity is what helps us gain the ability to pursue justice in our personal lives rather than demand it, which can easily become vengeance. Justice requires more than one person and can take time, patience, and even research to achieve.
The wisdom of Judy there. Let's have some of yours. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and tell us what justice is to you. Your answer could be anything from your favorite courtroom drama.
How many times have you been arrested as an adult, Mr. Little?
I lost count. No, don't have to take it personal.
You are feeding off the violence and the despair of the drug trade. You're stealing from those who themselves are stealing the lifeblood from our city. You are a parasite who leeches off
just like you,
the culture
man.
Of drugs. Excuse me? What?
I got the shotgun. You got the briefcase. It's on the game, though, right?
Or maybe it's an event in history that most represents justice to you. Or be a philosopher and talk like Plato and Cicero. We're going to learn more about them this hour. But first, we go to an issue, a place, and a conundrum, which perhaps best embodies our difficulty with the issue of deciding what is justice in 2013. That conundrum has a name, Gitmo. And the inmates at the Guantanamo Bay Detention Facility, most of whom are on hunger strike this week, are the unanticipated consequences of the War on Terror, a facility over which an American flag flies but exists in a constitutional netherworld, a facility President Obama believes should be closed. Here is the president speaking earlier this week.
I've asked my team to review everything that's currently being done in Guantanamo, everything that we can do administratively, and I'm going to re-engage with Congress to try to make the case that this is not something that's in the best interest of the American people.
Joining us now to talk about that conundrum of Guantanamo Bay is Jeffrey Rosen, professor of law at George Washington University Law School. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Good to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about if we're going to define what justice is in America, what about what is going on at Guantanamo Bay, what is unresolved at Guantanamo Bay, is the opposite of justice as we've come to understand it in the United States, if that's even a question that can be phrased?
It's an excellent question. And if it's possible to imagine what the opposite of justice would be, it'd be harder to come up with a better example than Guantanamo. The opposite of justice is a legal no man's land where people are held indefinitely without charge, without opportunity for release or prosecution, and without any sense of when they might be eligible for release or transfer or prosecution. The fact that 166 detainees continue to languish there has to be a dramatic example of injustice.
Broadly speaking, when we think about the War on Terror and the Guantanamo Bay symbol of the consequences of the War on Terror, how did we get into this mess? I mean, do legal scholars, are they in agreement that on some level certain aspects of the Constitution were simply tossed out the window in the fearful aftermath of September 11th?
I think the answer to that is yes. Guantanamo is a symbol or a representation tangibly of what happens when not only one but two administrations attempt to avoid legal and constitutional accountability. That's why it was set up in the first place. Guantanamo Bay was chosen because the Bush administration predicted inaccurately that the Supreme Court would not view Guantanamo as under constitutional restrictions at all. The Supreme Court rejected that claim. The Bush administration insisted that the detainees there could be held indefinitely without access to lawyers or the opportunity to challenge their convictions in court. The Supreme Court rejected that claim, too. Now, Congress responded to some of these Supreme Court rulings by authorizing detentions, and it's true that President Obama has found it harder to close the camp than he expected because of congressional pushback. But that doesn't change the fact that creating a constitutional no man's land is both constitutionally and morally indefensible and also a terrible way of preventing terrorism and running a justice system.
In our exploration of justice this hour, one of the issues that we will explore is the idea of consensus, that there has to be some sort of collective agreement on what constitutes justice and what constitutes injustice. And we get a lot of commentary on our website in response to the coverage that we do on Guantanamo Bay, and I think a lot of news organizations do as well, that somehow we're biased, that we don't acknowledge the possibility that the inmates at Guantanamo are in fact bad people and that they don't deserve any breaks whatsoever. But I'm thinking that constitutionally, we in America are supposed to agree at a very basic level that whatever we think about the inmates at Guantanamo, what's happening to them is wrong. That's not really a subject of debate in America right now. Yes or no?
Yes. The answer is absolutely yes. Even if we posited that each of the 106 remaining detainees was a dangerous terrorist, I can't think of a plausible argument that they could be held forever without either trial or possibility of reviewing the constitutionality of their detention. The Supreme Court has rejected that claim and said that the very essence of justice is the ability of to have some access to challenge the idea that you might be being wrongfully held. But it's not the case that all 166 are dangerous terrorists. By commonly accepted numbers, 24 of the detainees are considered eligible for possibly being prosecuted. There are 86 that have been cleared for transfer or release but are not being released because the administration thinks it's practically difficult to do so, and then 47 who are considered actively dangerous. That's just not fair.
Finally, the judicial history of the United States includes a lot of events that we understand clearly to be injustices down through history. I'm wondering where Guantanamo Bay will stand in that pantheon. Will it be like the Japanese internment cases of the World War II era? Will it be like the Reconstruction decisions that set the stage for the bitterness and the inequalities that motivated the civil rights movement? What do you think?
Those are both strong possibilities for historical analogies. Another one that comes to mind are the red baiting terrorism prosecutions during and after World War I, where suspected anarchists and socialists, including Eugene V. Debs, the socialist candidate for vice president, were prosecuted for their criticisms of the war in the face of fears about terrorism. Those gave rise to the greatest free speech dissents in American history, written by Oliver Wendell Holmes and Louis Brandeis, and came to spawn the American free speech tradition. And perhaps if there's any light that can come out of this sorry episode, it will be some reaffirmation of our constitutional ideals.
The symbolism of Guantanamo Bay and its legacy in the historical judicial history of the United States. Jeffrey Rosen is professor of law at George Washington University Law School. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
One of the great Supreme Court cases on the expansion of freedom and justice in America that Professor Jeffrey Rosen didn't mention is in full force at Gitmo and is 50 years old this year. That case is Gideon versus Wainwright, and it requires that an attorney be supplied to every defendant with the costs borne by the state. The Gideon case, which began when a Florida convict hand-wrote a letter to the U.S. Supreme Court, it ended up creating the U.S. Public Defender System. Access to state-appointed attorneys is now a principle recognized worldwide. But to our next guest, a public defender herself, justice is still a street fight up against a system that is stacked in favor of prosecutors. Robin Steinberg is the executive director of the Bronx Defenders, a public defender's office and legal services organization in the South Bronx, a place that ironically has been the inspiration for numerous courtroom dramas, but Steinberg says is no movie set.
The criminal justice system in 2013 is not The Good Wife. Very little goes on in the trial world in the criminal justice system. In the state system, about 2% of cases get tried. Somewhere between 2 and 5% get tried. 95% or more get plea bargained.
What's the most outrageous deal you've ever heard of in this very improvisational system?
Well, to give you a sense of how important a plea of any kind is to the prosecutor side, we had a client once who was charged with murder. We refused to take a plea. We kept marking it down for trial. And over the course of 2 years, the offer came down and down and down until eventually they offered a misdemeanor. Our public defender in the Bronx Defender's Office turned down the misdemeanor and said, how many times do we have to tell you? He wasn't there. He's not guilty. He's completely innocent of this charge and we're not taking a plea. They then offered us a disorderly conduct, which is not even a misdemeanor. It's a violation. And we turned it down and then they dismissed the case. But that's how strong the pressure to get any kind of plea out of a case and out of a human being is in the system these days.
So, you know, we talk in the justice system about this core value that underlies everything that's going on here, that the mission is to blank, you know, fairness, lofty philosophical kinds of stuff. What is the value, though, that drives this impulse to get a plea at all costs?
The only value there can be is efficiency. You know, the system, the state system is overloaded with people coming into the system, mostly charged, by the way, with minor misdemeanors at this point. So there is just under-resourced in every way, right? Judges are under-resourced, court parts, prosecutors, defenders, and you couldn't possibly have trials on all these cases. And so what happens is the pressure to plead guilty becomes incredibly intense. Everybody gets mad when you don't want to take a plea and you insist upon a trial. And when you insist upon a trial, at least in New York City in state court, you will have to wait anywhere from a year to 3 years to get your case to a trial. That means appearing in court every 3 weeks or every 4 weeks. That means sitting in jail if you can't afford bail, waiting for that case to get to trial and finally get your day in court. So it's hard to actually find what the core value is anymore in the criminal justice system.
And you've done this for, what, like 30 years?
30 years, yeah.
I mean, I hesitate to say you've seen everything, but...
I've certainly seen a lot.
What do defendants bring with them when they come into the system? I mean, I suspect they're coming with an image of the criminal justice system that maybe involves, you know, two parts Law and Order, one part The Wire. What do you have to surprise them with when they discover what's really going on?
I think that our clients coming into the criminal justice system are quite well aware of what's going on and what the criminal justice system is being used to do. I mean, in all candor, the criminal justice system in these days, at least in New York City and in most urban areas, are processing people for misdemeanors. The police are targeting poor communities, and particularly poor communities of color. And people have a very good sense of what's going on in the criminal justice system. They're being stigmatized.
So it's only people like me that have illusions about it. In the communities where this takes place, everybody understands what's going on.
I think there's a deep understanding of the function that the criminal justice system these days is playing, right? As we have watched zealous policing, zero tolerance policing, broken windows policing take over poor communities of color in the city. People are very aware whether or not they're being brought into the system as a quote-unquote defendant or whether they're just an observer. Everybody knows that the criminal justice system has reached very, very wide and very, very far into their communities. Leveling the playing field is simply impossible. Defender offices across this country are under-resourced. Prosecutors' offices, quite frankly, are under-resourced. Everybody's under-resourced in the criminal justice system. And so there's not really a leveling of the playing field. What you really have is the defender is the one person who stands up beside the person charged with a crime and speaks on his or her behalf and tries to put in context what the charge is and that particular act and tries very, very hard to fight against an entire system that is attempting to define that person in his or her entirety by that act. So we're the people sort of saying, look, even if this happened, let's look at the context. Let's look at this person's humanity. Let's look at their personal life. Let's look at their family. Let's look at their community with the hope that we can find some mitigation, that we can convince people to respect people's humanity and dignity through the process and can arrive at something that feels relatively fair.
Do you resent people like me and others, you know, talking about level playing fields and making these abstract kinds of statements about the criminal justice system working?
I don't resent it. I get frustrated sometimes by it. I get enraged a little bit by it. But at the end of the day, the value that we sort of really hope to hold is to educate the public about what's really going on in the criminal justice system. And I recognize that for people that live in more affluent communities, this is off the radar screen, that it's hard to believe. Most people that I tell these stories to find it hard to believe.
So people talk about slippery slopes, but you see just a big ledge and a drop-off.
I see a ledge and a drop-off in lots of ways in the criminal justice system. I mean, the thing that's most bizarre in some ways to me is for the past 20 years you have watched crime drop significantly in New York City and, frankly, across this country. And yet you see arrest numbers continue to go up. You would have expected to see the downsizing of prisons, the downsizing of jails, the downsizing of public defender offices, prosecutors' offices, and courthouses. And instead what you see is they have replaced arresting people who are charged with crime with really charging people with criminalization of behavior that's only criminalized in certain neighborhoods. By that I mean graffiti, trespass, sitting on a stoop and drinking a beer. Those are the kinds of things now that people are getting picked up for in certain communities, but not in other communities.
So I'm going to magically transform myself from the naive person who doesn't really understand what's going on the front lines, as you see it, to a judge. I give you the power to pluck somebody from the system over the last 30 years that if you had the power, you could just pull them out and send them on their way. Is there someone you would do? You would pluck from the system? You would reach in and get?
There are thousands and thousands of people that I would pluck from the system. I think there are thousands, tens of thousands, perhaps even hundreds of thousands of people whose cases never should have been brought at all, where the behavior that's been criminalized could have been resolved in a different way. You see it particularly in school-age high school kids. The fight in the playground between two kids that in my generation would have been resolved with a principal and a parent being called in or a principal and a caregiver being called in, the police get called. Writing on a desk in school, which I have to admit and probably on advice of counsel I shouldn't, I did as a child all the time. Writing on a desk in a public school in a neighborhood like the South Bronx can result in an arrest for criminal mischief, and we see those cases all the time. And that experience affects your life, particularly if you're a young person. Yes, there's the stigmatizing of a criminal conviction or the actual ramifications and collateral consequences of a conviction that could happen to you and your family. But the experience of being thrown up against a wall, being handcuffed, being talked to in a rough and vulgar way by the police, being thrown into the back of a car, taken to a precinct, locked in a cage, held there, brought underground to a criminal courthouse, sitting downstairs for 24 hours in a bullpen with 20 other men charged with anything from disorderly conduct to murder. That experience is not benign. That experience can really sear your soul and can, I think, affect particularly for young people the way they see themselves and the way they think the world sees them.
I have a 14-year-old daughter who very recently said with some real conviction, you know, what I want to do, Dad, is be a public defender.
That's awesome.
I know. It occurs to me to ask you, what tough lesson is she going to learn if she, you know, showed up at your office tomorrow?
She's going to learn that our society uses the criminal justice system in really onerous and destructive ways. She's going to see that it's unfair, grossly unfair. She's going to see that racism and classism basically permeate every single element of the criminal justice system in this country. She's going to see a lot of heartbreak, a lot of hardship. She's going to see poverty in ways that she's probably never seen it before. That having been said, she will see the incredible vibrancy and the incredible collaborative spirit of a community like the South Bronx. She'll see the clients who will come in and share their intimate stories and details with you, who you will frankly fall in love with and want to protect and want to help and want to stand in front of and want to empower to make their own decisions about what's important to them. And so there's a lot of hope in there too that she'll see.
For 30 years, you've been working in a system that you believe where the deck is stacked against you, yet you say you're lucky.
Incredibly lucky. I can't imagine doing any job that fulfills you the way that it does, that inspires in me the kind of passion that I feel for justice. It is a job that gives you way more than you're ever going to give it. And I feel like I've been lucky for 30 years to have that experience. I would recommend it to your daughter. I'd recommend it to anybody's daughter or son. We need more public defenders. We need more passionate people doing public defense. We need more people willing to look at the harsh realities of the criminal justice system and to really continue to get it out there into the world so that people like you and like other people who live in different kinds of communities and do different kinds of work really begin to understand and take it on as their own personal mission as well.
Robin Steinberg, Executive Director of the Bronx Defenders. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Justice, of course, is not simply about the courts or the judges and juries. Down through history, justice has been achieved by the actions of individual people who take risks, confront the state to right wrongs, Alabama school teacher Janice Kelsey is one of those people. On May 2, 1963, she was among hundreds of children who gathered in downtown Birmingham for a peaceful protest against the racial segregation of public schools. Just 16 years old at the time, Janice Kelsey explains how justice, in her case, was the scary decision to step outside of the only world she had ever known.
I had become accustomed to the way things were in terms of seeing the signs that indicated where I could drink water or use a restroom or sit and order food. I thought all was well, that we were separate, but I assumed equal. What confronted me about injustice was when it was brought to my attention that my school was inferior to the white schools in my area. It was shown that separate definitely was not equal. And that's where the fight began.
What do you think was justice for you back then as a 16-year-old? Was it something very simply to equalize what was going on in your schools? Was it integration? Was it compensation for the pain and the humiliation that you and your people had gone through?
No, I was fighting for equality. I wanted a level playing field. I wanted the same resources and opportunities that everybody else had. And it really, for me, was not about integration. I had friends whom I loved, and I wasn't trying to sit next to somebody I didn't know or get into a different school that I was not familiar with. But I wanted to make sure that what I had at my school was the same things that they had at other schools. I didn't want the hand-me-downs at my school, the used books, the used football equipment. I wanted to have the same things that everybody else had.
And how did you make the decision to act, to get out in front, to really be a part of this crusade, knowing that there could be real consequences?
Well, actually, I didn't know that murder and bombings and all that would be a part of possible consequences. I didn't know that there were so many reasons to be afraid. I knew that we had Klan activity in our communities, but I didn't think they would target kids. And I didn't know in advance that our Commissioner of Public Safety would target kids with dogs and hoses. I didn't foresee all of that. It didn't become a problem, or I didn't see it as a problem, until the 16th Street Church was bombed. That made me know this is still a problem.
A problem? It's a war.
Yes.
And you were a soldier.
Yes.
Did you want to just go home and say, all right, just kidding?
Did I want to go home at what point? No, not at any point. I did not want to go home when my parents came to sign me out of jail. I just went willingly with them, but I didn't want to go.
Is the fight for justice worth losing friends over?
I think yes.
Is it worth losing your parents' support over?
For justice, yes.
What about losing your life?
You know, I think if lives had not been lost, we wouldn't have gained what we have gained. I think it took some blood to get where we are. Sometimes it takes losing a life to draw attention to the severity of a problem.
But you came pretty close.
Well, I did. I didn't know it in advance.
Well, Janice, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you.
Janice Kelsey, a foot soldier in the 1963 Birmingham, Alabama Children's Crusade. She's now a retired educator. All of this that we've been talking about boils down to a simple ancient question. What is justice?
This is David from Huntington. Justice is whatever is convenient for law enforcement at such time. My friend and I were driving in my brother's old rusty Honda one day when out of nowhere, an unmarked police car came speeding up behind us. He pulled us over. He didn't say why he had pulled us over, just that we were to both get out of the vehicle. They searched both of us and the Honda. Whenever we asked why they were doing this, they got angry, eventually having both of us in handcuffs while they searched us again. After about half an hour of searching and not finding anything, they let us go without explanation.
is Mike Mount from South Carolina. We lived in California for many years, and we could not find a lawyer in the state who would represent us because the judge was retired and had too much power. Just typical of the old boy cronyism network in the East, much more of it in the West.
That cynicism and bitterness from two of our listeners is a long-recognized toxin in a democratic society. Patterns of perceived injustice erode the belief that our democratic institutions are concerned with everyone equally. Maybe they pick and choose between different groups to favor or disadvantage. Justice starts with a collective belief in fairness, which goes back to the days of Socrates and Aristotle and before. Put your philosopher hat on for us. Justice to me is, it's an ancient question. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Justice to me is, complete that sentence with anything from an episode of Law and Order to the Boston Celtics winning the NBA playoffs. You can say that, or something more high-minded and philosophical. For instance, how much does justice demand political loyalty?
You know, I think if you have an absolute sense of justice striving at the moral, you then have a responsibility to cultivate a sense of loyalty and emotional attachment that will make that real.
That's Martha Nussbaum, professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago Law School, who will be one of our guides through the big ideas of the ancients and how they relate to our times. Our other guide in this endeavor is David Miller, professor of political theory at the University of Oxford and author of Justice for Earthlings.
Although societies and institutions have many virtues, I think justice is always going to be the number one. And without justice, it's hard to see how any institution or how any society could be legitimate in the eyes of its members.
Miller cautions that in our time, justice does not always mean exact equality. And he notes the writings of American philosopher John Rawls from Harvard, who wrote a lot about inequality.
What Rawls said was that if you were going to have inequalities, they had to be justifiable to the people who had less. So he wasn't, of course, saying that every kind of resource, every kind of freedom must always be distributed in exactly the same way, in exactly an equal way. But he did think that if you were going to have some benefiting and not others, that had to be justifiable to the ones who got less. So I think that's a reasonable starting point for a discussion of justice.
Miller and Martha Nussbaum both believe that the issues of justice for our time, issues of economic justice, tolerance, pluralism, require that we all continually revisit what we mean by justice, just as the ancients did. And Professor Nussbaum says the ancients hardly ever agreed.
I think we need to distinguish three periods. The first period is the 5th century BC, a kind of high watermark period of the Athenian democracy. And there the thought was that everyone who was a citizen, which as I say was just 10%, was to be treated equally, and everything important was done by lottery. Then the second period is the period of the philosophers. Plato was in the next century, and he conducted a radical critique of that, proposed an ideal city where only certain very intellectually gifted people who were trained in mathematics and the sciences would have political power, and justice was thought to be an organic phenomenon. You had justice just by being subservient to the wise. And the ones that I really like, and what I call the third period, were the Stoic philosophers, who were the first ones who said that all human beings were born equal in dignity, and that therefore they ought to be treated with equal respect and given equal access to education and privileges, even if they weren't in our own country. And I think in all respects, they're the most attractive and interesting model for modern thought.
Professor Martha Nussbaum from the University of Chicago will be back with more from Nussbaum and Professor David Miller as we explore justice for earthlings here in the 21st century. What can we learn from the ancients? What could we teach them? This is The Takeaway. Continuing now with our exploration of what the ideas of justice given to us by the ancients in philosophy and religion mean in our time. Martha Nussbaum from the University of Chicago says that the ancients would find plenty to criticize about American democracy, but they would have marveled at how our system has held together even when tested by war, unrest, or even bad ballots in contested elections in our time.
Early in American history, there was a real risk in the early 19th century that things would fall apart. And then, of course, they did fall apart in the Civil War. And so the whole question of whether the polity would hold together was, for a long time, a really burning question. Now, what's interesting is that I think many people, if not most people, think that the decision in Bush v. Gore was not very well done. And that maybe, you know, in that sense, Gore was elected. But no one thought that there should be a revolution or an upheaval around that. They accepted the word of the court, even though they didn't actually think the justices had done a very good job. And I think that's basically true in the criminal justice system. This big racial divide makes for a lot of suspicion and skepticism. And I think that's one of the things we got to struggle with in the future, because the criminal justice system has served as a way of perpetuating the subordination of African Americans in many, many respects. For example, taking away the vote for life if you're convicted of a felony and so forth. So we need to work on that.
Maintaining loyalty to the system while ensuring equality, it's an ancient issue of justice revised by the multicultural societies in our day. David Miller from the University of Oxford says multiculturalism complicates some issues the ancients may have seen as settled.
I think that despite very wide cultural variations, and I've done a bit of research on this, at the very basic level, I think people everywhere think somewhat the same about issues of justice. But it does complicate it when it comes to a more applied level, because then you have to ask about the ways in which culture frames and conditions the kinds of decisions that people have to make and the kind of constraints that it imposes upon people. So I think that justice in our kind of society has to be alert to culture, but not because it creates some fundamental barrier to understanding between people.
Figuring out how to enforce justice or execute justice in these multicultural communities, you talk a lot about tipping points and thresholds, in the sense that there has to be a level of consensus so that the loyalties are clear. And we've seen here in the United States just recently this question of two young boys being apparently loyal to some community that they didn't live in, far away in Chechnya, motivated them to take out actions on people in their own community. Now, terrorism has very little to do with justice here, but I'm just wondering if it's possible to even track the extent to which people feel loyal to one group or another in a multicultural society.
Well, I think it's a very important issue. I think that the idea of justice, and particularly the idea of social justice, which has been the main idea throughout the 20th century and into the 21st, does rely upon the idea that people see themselves as belonging primarily to one particular community. And so when people migrate, for example, the expectation has to be that they take on a new allegiance to the society they join. And I think if we were to get into a situation where that was no longer the case, then our thinking about justice would have to begin to change in ways perhaps we wouldn't want. So I think it probably reinforces the point that nation building in the context of immigration is going to be an important ongoing project if we care about justice domestically as well as globally.
David Miller of the University of Oxford.
There's another thing that I want to raise here, which is economic justice between nations.
Martha Nussbaum of the University of Chicago was very anxious to say that the ancients might be particularly interested in the competition for resources between very unequal nations today.
Because when we talk about the U.S. and then we talk about India, well, the difference in life expectancy, the difference in all kinds of opportunities is vast. But then if we were to take in the poorest nations in the world, for example, some of the nations of southern Africa, we would quickly have much more inequality even than that. The life expectancy at birth in some nations is about 45 years. Life expectancy at birth in the U.S. is by now 80 years. So what are we going to do about that? What are we going to do about access to nutrition, to basic life opportunities, to pharmaceuticals in the nations of the world that are not as rich and advantaged as our own? And I think that's the big problem of justice that I would like to see the 21st century focus on.
What do you think Plato would say about that precise problem that you've outlined?
Well, I think Plato had absolutely no interest in anything that took place outside the city itself, except insofar as it might be attacked by its enemies. So I think he would say that's not our affair. But Cicero would strongly disagree, and Cicero would say that we really owe it to people who were being attacked by their enemies elsewhere to intervene and to help them in their struggle for justice.
Cicero is very interesting because he actually has an idea which I also find quite illuminating, which is the idea of concentric circles of justice, starting with a small group and then going out wider and wider until it encompasses the world as a whole. So I think he would see that there's lots that needs to be done, not only in our cities and our states, but in the world. But I think he would still recognize the ideas that we have and would have some idea about what would need to be done to make those ideas a reality. Plato, I think, is more difficult because Plato has a very simple sort of monolithic idea of justice that I find harder to get to grips with.
And to say nothing of the fact that he would completely be a fish out of water in our society with all these books and iPads and computers. He would break out into quite a rash, I suspect.
I think that might well be true.
It's David Miller, professor of political theory at the University of Oxford, author of Justice for Earthlings, and Martha Nussbaum, professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago Law School. Join them. Get philosophical with us. Justice to me is, complete that sentence, at 877-8-MY-TAKE. For many, though, this is the voice of justice.
The defendant is not guilty. But somebody in this courtroom is. Now, gentlemen, in this country, our courts are the great levelers. In our courts, all men are created equal.
Gregory Peck playing the fictional Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird. Another case of justice denied coming up, a real one.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
As we've seen all this hour, the struggle for justice, for a just society, for a just verdict, is this unlikely combination of philosophical ideas fused with some collective sense of morality and fairness, but then ignited at crucial moments in history by the actions of individuals who step up and show they're willing to die or to take a stand, to risk the full wrath of the majority or the state itself. Hunger strikers at Gitmo, civil rights protesters, a single convict petitioning the highest court in the land, a man condemned to die. Kirk Noble Bloodsworth is one of these actors on the grand stage of justice. 20 years ago, he walked out of a Maryland prison, the first inmate in the nation to be sentenced to death and then exonerated by DNA evidence. In 1984, he was a former Marine with no criminal record working as a fisherman on the eastern shore of Maryland when someone thought Bloodsworth looked like the police sketch of the suspect in the rape and murder of a 9-year-old girl outside Baltimore. He was arrested and charged with first-degree murder. Bloodsworth's faith in his country's sense of justice, something he had defended as a U.S. Marine, was eventually broken. When his trial began, Kirk says that he naively thought the truth would set him free.
Well, I certainly felt that way when this whole thing began. You know, I sat in a 2-week trial, prosecutors calling me a monster, 5 identification witnesses positively identifying me as the last person seen with Dawn Hamilton, the victim in this case. I mean, it just didn't turn out the way I had planned at all. I figured after they hear my side of it and, you know, my alibi and all that stuff, it would all be over, but it didn't happen that way.
And when, in the course of the trial, did you understand that there wasn't any kind of spooky hand of justice over the courtroom that was going to come in here and set things right?
Well, that's make-believe. That's only in the movies. The reality of the situation was that I sat in this thing and I was telling the truth. And you know, this whole thing was based on identification, you know, faulty identification of the person they said they saw. 2 little boys identified this person as being 6'5", blonde curly hair, bushy mustache, tan skin, and skinny. Well, John, if your audience could see me, I'm about 6 foot tall. I weighed about 2 1/4 back in those days. I don't tan, I burn. My hair was as red as a fire plug in 1984. Never been arrested, honorably discharged Marine. You know, it just never fit. In the end, you know, the real perpetrator of the crime was 5'6" and 160 pounds.
Why, if it doesn't fit. How come it fits for a jury and a set of prosecutors who really want somebody to pay for a crime that is as horrible as the one you were charged with?
You know, they tried. They did a really good job of putting a square peg in a round hole, so to speak. You know, my lawyer, you know, he comes into the prison visit room to visit me and to talk about the case, and he sits with his back to a brick wall, and we have to talk through that glass partition, like, on the telephone.
Mm-hmm.
And when he's sitting there with his back to the brick wall, and the first thing out of his mouth, he tells me, he says, Kirk, you're in a lot of trouble. He says, but don't worry, I know my way around the courtroom, and I know my way around the criminal justice system. We're going to find our way out of here together. And we talked about the case for a little bit, and right before he gets ready to leave, he reiterated what he said in the beginning. He says, Kirk, I know my way around the courtroom. Puts his hand on the glass, John, to say goodbye. Picks up his briefcase, turns around, and runs into the wall.
Oh,
I mean,
God.
This was my, you know, this was my life. And I was, you know, the prosecution had all the elements to make 24 people, because I had two different trials, believe something that wasn't true. And it happens all the time. It's an adversarial system of justice. A lot of times it's adversarial to the truth. It's what they can make 12 people believe. And in the end, you know, it almost cost me my life.
Well, it cost you something. I mean,
it cost me 8 years, 10 months and 19 days and 2 years on death row for something I didn't commit.
During that time when you were convinced that there was a way, even back before DNA evidence was used, you were convinced there was a way to prove you were innocent. Did you think that would be justice?
I thought that maybe they would realize they had made a mistake. You know, I still had belief that these people weren't physically trying to railroad me through this thing. I mean, it was my belief, but once they had convicted me, they didn't want to go back and check anything. I mean, the evidence was right in front of them. They had a police report about Kimberly Shea Ruffner, who was the real perpetrator in this crime, who was released 2 weeks before Dawn's murder for two attempted rapes of two other little girls in Baltimore. And the police report came in 9 days or 8 days before my arrest, and they never went back to check.
Now, a lot of people are going to look at your story, listen to you talking, and say, well, you know, mistake there in the early going, but through technology and people working really hard, he was able to walk out of prison. Man, we got a great criminal justice system that allows that to happen. Boy, that wouldn't happen anywhere else in the world. What do you say to them?
Well, the organization that I work for, as you know, I'm the advocacy director for Witness to Innocence. If that was true, we wouldn't have 142 exonerated death row survivors in the United States. You know, we have over 300 wrongfully convicted people in the country as well. The National Registry quotes it at 1,050 now. I don't see that as a system working. I was the one that found out about the DNA. They had no idea where the evidence was. And in the end, it was sitting in the judge's closet in a paper bag in a cardboard box. It was not the system that saved me. It was me. I saved myself. And no person in the United States should have to face that.
Kirk, what was taken from you in this whole experience here?
They took my life and my benefit of the doubt. I never had a shot at it in the end. And I suffered at the hands of a system that, you know, it almost took my life. So I lost my mother 5 months before I got out of prison. I never got to see her in this 10 years. She never got to see her son. And, you know, the perpetrator of this brutal murder of Dawn Hamilton left unchecked, and I could have been executed.
You know, you describe this story of you having to save yourself for those years when you were in prison, you having to convince the system to pay attention to you when it had no incentive to do so. And now you describe the only way you're going to get your life back is for you to do it yourself. And you're a waterman. And I have to say that metaphor of a lone guy on a boat in the dark waters trying to make things right for himself is not my favorite image of a system of justice, Kirk.
Well, I have 141 other men and women behind me. I mean, I can either crawl and lay down and just let this thing overtake me, or do something about it. And that's what I've chose the latter, to do something about it. You know, it's in my heritage. I think most watermen are pretty stalwart, and we stand up. My mother used to say that all the time. You know, stand up for what is right, because right is light.
Kirk Bloodsworth, former death row inmate who was exonerated by DNA evidence, he is now the advocacy director for Witness to Innocence, and one of the main reasons why the state of Maryland formally abolished the death penalty this week. That elusive idea of justice, many of you see it out there. Voice from Delaware, what justice? When we watch those who collapsed this country and those who enabled them to collapse the economy, we don't see justice. Or South Carolina. I've learned that there is no justice that comes from our court system. We have a legal system. However, justice is not the objective. Or Austin, Texas. Justice is now a euphemism for vengeance. The news is replete with calls for justice when what I think they're really saying is kill them. Whatever your concept of justice, let's agree to keep fighting for it. A final thought on the people waiting for some kind of justice down at Guantanamo Bay, where we began this hour. 166 prisoners, 100 on hunger strike, some being force-fed, 24 eligible to be prosecuted, 47 unprosecutable but considered actively dangerous, and 86 officially cleared for transfer or release, caught for now in the system. Thanks so much for listening to this special hour, especially to those of you listening for the first time on Northern Public Radio, WNIJ, at Northern Illinois University. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation.